more, but how do you measure your practice? It's hard. You don't. I just know I'm practicing. Recently, I've been investigating this story. Before the Buddha became the Buddha, he was a bodhisattva. What's a bodhisattva? We are all bodhisattvas. A bodhisattva is a person who as much as they're able, consciously sets aside their own ego and selfing to serve all beings. That's us. So there's this Jataka tale, which are tales that talk about the Buddha's previous lives. And in this particular life, the Bodhisattva was walking in the forest. And he looked down. Shh. Whoa. There's a starving lioness down there with her cubs. What is an action? When he looked down and saw these cubs, his heart was broken open with compassion, bearing witness to the suffering. Because this suffering was not just the lioness and her cubs suffering, it was his suffering. And with that, he jumped. He jumped off the cliff and offered himself to the lioness. There's a beautiful picture on the internet of this story. And it shows, it's kind of reddish and orangish. It's brilliant in its depiction of this story. It shows the bodhisattva flying through space and the lioness and her cubs below. I feel that this, what I would describe as a loving action by this bodhisattva was a culmination of training the heart and mind, moment by moment, day by day, week by week, lifetime after lifetime. So how is this story relevant to us? Am I saying go jump off cliffs? No. And I'm saying yes. The no is, the cliff is a metaphor to the cliffs that we jump off every day, whether we know it, whether we're conscious or not. What does that look like? When you get married, that's kind of jumping off a cliff. Though I've never been married, but I've kind of heard that. And I'm not saying it in a negative way at all. Okay, I'm not. I'm just saying that there's a lot of energy and faith going into the practice of marriage, and also of letting go of self to serve another being. Having babies, children, experiencing death. I just bring these forward as opportunities we have, and there are 10,000 other opportunities that each of us could come up with where we jump, we let go of all we know on behalf of all beings, on behalf of ourselves, on behalf of the person in front of us. Everyone's included. So how do we train the heart mind for these moments? How do we develop wisdom to discern skillful action? Skillful action individually and skillful action collectively. Specifically, how do we as Buddhists respond to white supremacy, to the alt-right? And if you're white, our white fragility in the midst of all this. What is our responsibility as a Buddhist community in dismantling racism? Is there an intersectionality between the Buddhist community and interfaith communities in the agony and horror of bearing witness to Charlottesville, Virginia? These are some questions that I've been asking myself, not just since Charlottesville, before that. Because I've had this feeling in my heart and mind that it's not going to get better if I do not participate actively in direct action to what's happening in our world, in our communities. And I cannot do this in a violent way. I cannot. Though that, for me, when I think of violence and anger, that the anger does arise. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to minimize it. It does arise. So I made a decision after a discussion with a Dharma sister who shall not be named, that I would apply at Tassajara for the fall practice period in September. And I was accepted. And the reason I'm going is because, and I'll talk more about it, is I have the capacity to concentrate. But what is needed is beyond concentration. What is needed is wisdom. And right now I don't have a lot of wisdom. I'm going to be honest, and I'm not going to fake it. I'm not going to pretend I have something I don't have. And I'm open. I'm open to developing wisdom. How can I contribute to the current conditions of the world as they present themselves in a way that is not violent, in a way that is not squishy, in a way that I'm not collapsing in my fragility as a white person, as a woman? How do I stand up upright, as Gandhi would say, with my spine in alignment? Because imagine this, try it out. Not now, later. What it feels like when your spine is upright. It's empowering compared to a spine that's collapsed. These retreats are an opportunity to gather the heart and mind, to soak the spirit in the vast ocean. This cleansing provides a means to contribute to one's individual and collective well-being. We practice developing samatha. In Zen, it's shikantaza, just sitting, which is important. And sometimes some of us, to get to just sitting in an open awareness, we need a little more instruction. I need a little more instruction. What does that mean to just sit with an open mind? What does that mean to, how do I experience that open-mindedness, that emptiness, that boundlessness? Because I'm not a saint. I'm a human being walking on this planet with this personality, with this character. So how do I develop that? So samatha is calming the mind. It's stilling mental activity. Samatha is connected to samadhi. Samadhi is not a blissed out state. It's not a blissed out condition. Though that may be part of the experience, is rapture. That's jhana. That's another discussion. What I'm talking about is stilling the mind, gathering it, so it's not scattered everywhere. It's not scattered on Facebook. It's not scattered with the family. It's not scattered with this present moment. It's gathering all the conditions, all the mental phenomena together. Samadhi comes from classical Ashtanga yoga, that it's eight limbs. Samadhi is the eighth limb of classical Ashtanga yoga. In Buddhism, it's the beginning. Samadhi, Samadhi. Sam, bringing together, collecting, A, coming together. So you keep bringing the mind, collecting the mind. D, to place, boom. You place the mind. So the mind becomes an instrument. Bringing the mind together in a state of concentration. Once the mind is together in that way, in that concentrated state, we have the possibility of insight. If the mind is filled with feelings, sensations, as much chaos in the outer world, in the inner world, it's very difficult to have insight. If I'm like so focused on preparing for Tassajara, somebody said to me, you cannot read the Golden Sutra because your mind is too busy. I'm like, bummer. But it's true. How can I read the Golden Sutra when I'm so focused on, can I rent my place? What am I going to do about my job? Blah, 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 blah. You can't possibly read something so subtle and inconceivable as the Golden Sutra with a mind like that. So this stilling the mind is very important. So the other side is the combination of insight. In Buddhism, it's prajna, wisdom. In the Heart Sutra, it's wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. It's beautiful, but I'm not there. I can say the words. So how do we train the mind? What does the Buddha say? The Buddha says a lot. And this is just one. There are like three others like this. There's a Buddhist scholar, Bhikkhus Bodhi, if you get a chance to check him out. He's awesome. He's really got the sutras down, and he's also got the Abhidharma down. So in the Anguttara Nikaya, this is what the Buddha says. This is directly from the Buddha about training. Bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, because the Buddha talked to both men and women. Just saying. There are these three trainings. What three? The training in the higher virtuous behavior, the training in the higher mind, and the training in the higher wisdom. And what bhikkhus in is the training in the higher virtuous behavior? Here, a bhikkhus is virtuous, having undertaken the rules / precepts for us. She trains in them. This is called the training in the higher virtuous behavior. And what, bhikkhus, is the training in the higher mind? Here, secluded from sensual pleasures, right? Lust. Ooh, that's charged, right? And that's just not sexual. That's lust, greed, combined together. that controls the mind. The mind does not control it. Secluded from unwholesome thoughts, greed, anger, ignorance, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in the first jhana. I'll talk about the jhanas in September. This is called the training in the higher mind. In what, bhikkhus, is the training in the higher wisdom? Here, with the destruction of the taints, a bhikkhu realizes for herself with direct knowledge in this very life the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. And having entered upon it, she dwells in it. These bhikkhus are the three trainings, straight from the Buddha. So, no easy task for us. Virtuous conduct. We chant the precepts, and we practice them to the best of our ability. Recognizing that I am not separate from all that is, I take up the way of non-killing. We are interconnected with all beings, whether we believe it or not. Being satisfied with what I have, I take up the way of non-stealing. And non-stealing can be very subtle. It can be as subtle as taking somebody's idea or a project. It's not just taking material objects. It's subtle. And how do we get to that subtlety? We train our mind. Encountering all creation with respect and dignity, I take up the way of not misusing sexuality. Listening and speaking from the heart, I take up the way of not speaking falsely. Cultivating a mind that sees clearly, I take up the way of not being deluded and not giving or taking intoxicants. So there are many other precepts, and I invite you, just take one and practice with it and see what happens. That is the practice of virtuous conduct. So the mind, when it is free from the hindrances, and I know that we have talked about the hindrances before, lust, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. Those can eat away at the mind. It's like a rust. It's very corrosive and scratchy on the mind. And what we're trying to do is move from the course into refining the mind. So practices that help support this training beyond, including following the precepts, zazen, meditation, developing an understanding of the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the origin of suffering, cessation, and the path. These practices support the mind developing mental stability. And mental stability, it not only supports one's well-being, it supports everybody's well-being. Because you're coming from a place of uprightness. Leading to the possibility of serenity of a concentrated mind. And it's the concentrated mind. This is important, to have a concentrated mind. But what's happening underneath is that the hindrances, if the hindrances aren't addressed and one is not living by the precepts, there's this bubbling of what's happening, the hindrances, the ill will, the greed, anger, and ignorance are bubbling underneath the surface. So even though one is meditating, when you're out of the meditation, somebody comes up to you and you're like, the anger or the ill will or whatever arises. It's like, what just happened? Well, what's happening is that the mind is being gathered, but it's not able to sustain that state of concentration because the insight is not there. So how do we develop the insight? And what is this insight? The mind being collected on the object, whether it's the breath or space, that supports the possibility of insight. And the insight or the wisdom that is the Prajnaparamita that the Buddha speaks of is this. And again, this sutta is in this Nikaya. A certain monk asked the Blessed One, "Is it said, Bhante, a wise person of great wisdom, a wise person of great wisdom? In what way is one a wise person of great wisdom? Here, monk, a wise person of great wisdom does not intend for his own affliction or for the affliction of others or for the affliction of both. Rather, when she plans for her own welfare, the welfare of others and the welfare of both. In the welfare of the whole world, it is in this way that one is a wise person of great wisdom." No one is left out, including you, including me, including this great earth. We're all included in this great wisdom. I want to be respectful of time because I really want to hear from you as well. And usually I always go over and don't hear from you. So I'm trying to make a promise to myself and to you silently that I want to hear from you. I don't always need to talk. So when wisdom is developed, ignorance is abandoned. Ignorance is like a root that supports all these defilements, all these hindrances, all this separation from others, or even calling others other. Samadhi supports removing the obstructions to the mental development, purifying the mind to be an effective instrument to developing wisdom. The combination of virtuous behavior, concentration, and wisdom is a radical, transformative training. One is the bodhisattva, the lioness, the cubs, the space, and the loving action of the jump. I want to end with a poem, Eroha. It's a Japanese poem, and I feel that it really embodies the three marks of Buddhism. No centralized self, life is impermanent, and dukkha is pivoted to sukha. Although its scent still lingers on the form of a flower, the flower has scattered away. For whom will the glory of this world remain unchanged? Arriving today at the yonder side of the deep mountains of the evanescent existence, We shall never allow ourselves to drift away intoxicated in the world of shallow dreams. I want to read that once more. Although its scent still lingers on the form of a flower that is scattered away, for whom will the glory of this world remain unchanged? Arriving today at the yonder side of the deep mountains of evanescent existence, we shall never allow ourselves to drift away intoxicated in the world of shallow dreams. This is how we address the suffering in the world. And as a white woman, Zen priest, I vow to unravel and untangle the ancient twisted karma of genocide of the Dakota Nation, of our brown and black relatives in this country. Thank you.
Gigi, why don't you say what Tassajara is? Because some people might not know what you're venturing into in terms of Tassajara.
Oh, okay.
I know, but other people don't know.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Tassajara is kind of like a equivalent to a Harvard Ivy League school in Zen Buddhism. Seriously, why do I say that? You laugh. I'm serious. Tenshin Reb Anderson is a direct descendant in the lineage of Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi. And that's who I will be studying with. And I am very honored and blessed to have been accepted. So I will be getting up early in the morning, clearing this mind from September 26th to December 20th for 3 months. So when I come back, I'll be ready to rock and roll. Okay, thank you. So I'd like to just open it up to questions and comments.
Where is that? Oh, I was just going to say, where is that located?
Oh, in the mountains of California.
Okay. When I think of oppression by white people, and the great masters that defeated that oppression, I'm thinking of Mahatma Gandhi, for example. Mm-hmm. What qualities they had. I don't think he was Buddhist, but he was Hindu. So there's like overlap there. So I'm just, you know, I have this, the movie Gandhi that I watch over and over and over, and it's like I want to know. Mm-hmm. I still don't have an answer.
Okay, may I just say something to your question, and then if anybody else has anything to add.
Can you repeat the question, please? The
question is
no. For let GD do it, because then she can.
Okay.
Okay, and if I do not represent you accurately, please let me know. The question is, what are the qualities that Mahatma Gandhi and other leaders within social action had that they could do the kinds of transformative practices that they did? Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, and I'd like to say something and then invite you to also step forward. There's a book out there called the Gandhian iceberg that some of us have studied. And it's got three components coming from Gandhi. The first is self-purification. That's the spiritual practice of clearing the mind and cleaning the mind up so the mind becomes an instrument. The second practice is developing constructive programming, which would be equivalent to social programming within one's community. Co-ops and other kinds of activities that meet the needs of the community. And then the last action is satyagraha. That's the actual action of putting your body on the line. Yeah, it's like the Buddha jumping off the cliff. It's no small thing, and it's done with wisdom to give your body. And that's what people at Standing Rock did, the native people and the allies. They were very clear, and it was satyagraha. They placed their bodies on the front line for water and for us. Does anybody have anything to say about Gandhi or King or,
yeah? You know, Gandhi is enlightened, and there's a lot of, despite the fact there that, you know, there's a billion Hindus, and they hate the Pakistanis. Why? It's because they're Muslims. You know, I'll give you a very good example. I was traveling in northern China, and I had a guide and a driver. The driver would not eat lunch with me because I'm Christian. Well, not Christian, because I come from a Christian country. Well, just like in Burma, you think there are these a Buddhist country, they'd be enlightened, but they hate the Rohingyas because they're Muslim. And I think last week there, I said there, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we were all racist because the blacks were way down, and then there was the Jews and then the Norwegians. We have all these biases that's sort of ingrained in us. You know, it'll take generations and generations there to get rid of that. Why? Look at a couple of days ago, you got these white racists there marching down the street. You think they're there in 19, what is it, there in our age here, that'd be gone there, but we still have a fraction there that's remain unenlightened. It'll take generations here before these ingrained biases there will go away.
Mm-hmm. To address that, you know, it is really sad when we think about how religious movements, which start out full of promise to help us live better lives, connect better with each other, become co-opted by political agendas, which often include oppression, outright persecution, marginalization of different groups that supposedly don't adhere to their beliefs. And if you want to investigate that more, there's a book by Karen Armstrong, which is very large, and you better like history because it's full of examples of how this has happened. She uses particular examples of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But, you know, we can apply it to any religion, any large religion that does ally itself with a political agenda. So,
well, you know, it's not just religion. It's just not just religion there. You know, what is it, 50 years ago there, we sort of discriminated against the Italians.
Mm-hmm.
And we discriminated against the Swedes.
I wonder if we can continue this conversation after.
Sure. Is there any other? I don't want to cut you off, Bob. I think that's part of why we practice in moving it forward. And Mahatma Gandhi was one man, and he was revolutionary in what he did. Martin Luther King was one person, and he was radical in what he did. There are many people, it takes one person to move an action forward. It takes one person on the bus seeing an injustice, going up and saying, you know, that's not right. These aren't big actions. As well as going into the street, there are many ways to participate in this. Does anybody, do you have a question or a comment?
I just wanted to make a comment that I think it has a lot to do with the ego, and I don't think it's something that will ever go away unless you personally can shine a light on that in yourself and realize just even the little things that you don't accept, you know, that whether it's somebody's hair color or the car they drive or how much money they make or religion or the big stuff. And it really starts at home.
I would say not getting rid of your ego, going through it, really bearing witness to what's in front of you. Oh, that's how I look? Wow. You know something? I'm going to still love you and befriend you, and you're not going to drive the bus. I mean, really. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
I just was interested when you said fragile white, my fragile white.
White fragility.
Yeah, white fragility. I hadn't heard that before, and it's
jarring. Yeah, there's a person, Robin DiAngelo. She's done scholarly work on white fragility. What it is, essentially, is that when there's a discussion about racism or discrimination or white supremacy, many of us will get defensive right away. Oh, I'm not racist, or I don't have any of those qualities. I'm an open-minded person. And also we don't have a language for our articulation when it comes to racism and white supremacy and nationalism. So we immediately shut down. So it's just like any other kind of practice. It's developing a language around it. It's having conversations with people as a way to develop and let go of our white fragility. It's the idea that white people can be conflict avoidant. We can be conflict avoidant with all this mess. Just saying. Does that answer your question? So we got 2 minutes, and I want to give whoever... Yes?
I have a question. When you were reading from the rather large book, the Nikaya, you talked about kind of like the three things, like I think it was like conduct, or like how you... Your virtuous conduct, and then concentration, and then wisdom. Do you view those as kind of like stages, or kind of like circular feeding into one another, or is it like wisdom's up here, and you need to have the conduct? And the...
Well, it's really difficult to have wisdom if I'm like a bully and mean-spirited. Mm-hmm. That's not very wise, and that conduct's not very virtuous. And if I'm not concentrated, if I'm scattered, it's very difficult for me to have insight into my behavior and what's going on. Some people have looked at it as like a stool, right? You need the three stands or poles of the stool. You need all three of them for the stool to be upright and to be able to sit on it. Other people... I did hear Bhikkhus Bodhi say that it's the virtuous behavior feeds into the concentration, which feeds into the wisdom. So, and then it goes back, because it's always a spiral. It, one never arrives. It's continuous, unending, inconceivable. Okay, thank you for the question. So it's 10:30. I want to respect people's time and thank you for your questions and thank you for your presence, everybody.
The closing chant is on the front of your bulletin. May our intention equally penetrate every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.